Coming up on this week's book show, Ayad Akhtar is a novelist and playwright, winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. His latest is a novel, Homeland Elegies, a deeply personal work about identity and belonging in a nation coming apart at the seams. It blends fact and fiction to tell an epic story of longing and dispossession in a world that 9/11 made. Ayad Akhtar on this week's book show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ayad Akhtar is a novelist and playwright and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Drama for his play, Disgraced. His latest is a novel, Homeland Elegies, a deeply personal work about identity and belonging in a nation coming apart at the seams. It blends fact and fiction to tell an epic story of longing and dispossession in the world that 9/11 made. Part family drama, part social essay. At its heart, it's the story of a father, a son, and the country they both call home. Again, the new book is Homeland Elegies, a novel, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Ayad Akhtar to this week's book show. I will tell you that this book has meant a lot to me, and I have read it, and I have listened to you read it, and it is something that stays with you for a very long time. Let us begin with the obvious question of your decision to write it in the way that you did, of this, as I mentioned in the introduction, this blend of fact and fiction.
It's complicated. I knew that writing about the political moment that we're in, you know, the book is a response to what's happened to the country, and writing about the present in a vivid and direct way was going to be challenging in fictional form, because it was invariably, I mean, the reality that we're living through is so crazy that it would be hard to do it justice in a third person narrative, or, you know, sort of obviously fictional character, for it to not feel like a satire. And I didn't want it to feel like satire. And I wanted the book to be able to address the reader about our collective life together, our politics, if you will, in the deeper sense of the word. And I wanted to do it with the kind of immediacy of nonfiction, but I'm not a nonfiction writer, so I couldn't write nonfiction. And I, you know, it's by cast of, by my creative sort of self is I'm a dramatist. And so I'm sharpening edges, and I'm heightening conflict, and I'm compositing characters. And that's what I just naturally do. My imagination always tends to that direction. I wouldn't know how to write if I couldn't do that. So pivoting away from satire into memoir, into first person narrative that fakes, if you will, or blurs the line between truth and fiction, between reality and illusion, which is, of course, I think in many ways the fundamental dilemma that we're up against, is that we no longer share a collective sense of what the facts are or what reality even is.
That's an interesting point. So it in that way, it is very reflective of the time. Do you want us as the reader to think about that as the reading, to try to decipher what may be real, what may be fiction?
I'm less concerned about the sort of code part of it, or the Romana Clay part of it. I'm more trying to breach a certain kind of dwindling focus on the part of the reader, and by that reader I mean myself. I'm trying to get inside a reader's consciousness, where we have increasingly substituted entertainment for thought and entertainment for reality, and we are looking to good narrative to provide us a metric for what truth is. We are being entertained. We are in a showbiz era of information. And so playing that game with the reader is less about sort of tricking them and more about trying to gain access to an immediacy of their focus so that we can have a meaningful, vivid conversation about what has happened to the country.
There is, as I mentioned in the introduction, part, as I said, part family drama, part social essay. The family part, and especially the relationship with your father, talk a little bit about that and the timing and why it was so poignant for you.
Well, you know, in a lot of ways, the sort of, for those who've read the book and maybe those who haven't read it yet, there is a breathless urgency to the voice of the book, that there is a kind of a sweep and a alacrity and a kind of intensity of the language. And that was not by design. That sort of like poured out of me. And I think a lot of that had to do with the emotional circumstance of writing this book. My mom had passed away and my father was showing very, very severe signs of sort of decline, was suffering through late stage alcoholism. And this storied career he had made as a cardiologist, one of the great cardiologists of his generation, and he, you know, was in tatters, and sort of dealing with that in the wake of dealing with what had been happening politically in this country, which, you know, for me was not really that much of a surprise. And I think it was still incredibly disturbing, and all of those things meant that I was writing at this kind of fevered pitch and in this fevered way. One of the things that I say about the book is that I'm trying to tell the story of what happened to America in the last half century, a half century that marks exactly the 50 years that my parents were here. They're no longer with us. They're no longer with me. Their generation of immigrants, professional immigrants, all came over about the same time, and they've all been through this half century of their American experience, and us, their children born here, have gone through some aspect of our own. And I wanted to tell that story or those stories to sort of shed light on what America has become.
Just the title, Homeland Elegies, we think of an elegy often as a lament for the dead, which is essentially, for your parents, is what this is.
Yes, absolutely. But it's also an elegy for the passing of their homeland. That is to say, the place that they came from, which, you know, I never did. They always called it back home. And I always sort of thought of it as a place that they were from. And now that connection, the connection to that world, is also severed. But there's also, you know, the subliminal play on the notion of homeland security and the sort of the dilemma of being a Muslim American in a post 9/11 United States. And then there's the elegy for the heartland where I come from, for Wisconsin, life in Wisconsin, the portrait of Wisconsin stands in for a larger portrait of the country, where we have really despoiled our national infrastructure for personal benefit, and where the consequences of our politics, I mean, what has happened politically, to my mind, has less, although it has become an issue of identity for everyone, including the president. The sort of genesis of this, to me, if I look at what's happened in Wisconsin, is less about identity and more about, you know, the despoiling of our nation over the past 40 years. So wanting to tell all those stories through an elegy, in an elegiac way, and sort of really acknowledge the passing of so many things. And is there something on the other side of it? Will we be reborn? Will there be a new life? Perhaps. But I think it's hard to not look at what has happened to the country and recognize something has died.
There is also a deep story about money, on the role of money, and for you as an artist and in making it and not making it, and of course the money that is available to you and to your father.
I do think that the making of money is the expression of American will par excellence. And I don't mean that as a judgment. I just mean it as an observation. American success and the American dream is ultimately defined by economic prosperity. And that on some level, if I was really to sort of dig deep into the meaning of my parents' arrival in this country and what it really represented, both geopolitically, but also personally, what was the thing they were pursuing? Well, it was an image of America that was, of course, fueled by this extraordinary economic prosperity of the post-war years. And that what was the sale what was the idea, the fundamental idea? What was it that they could have in this new world, this prosperous new world that they couldn't have back home, in which my mother felt that she never got sufficient compensation, as I say in the book, for, you know, what she'd left behind by all of the bounties of this new country that she came to. But what was that? And ultimately, what it really does boil down to, and I don't mean it cynically, I just mean it as an observation of fact, it boils down to the ability to succeed economically. The how that is still can't redeem the larger collapse of a collective vision of what it means to be American. American, being American can't just be about me making it. It can't just be about my individual success. But unfortunately, it seems that that's what it has become for all of us.
Ayad Akhtar is our guest. The name of the new novel is Homeland Elegies, a novel. It is published by Little Brown. Do you think that you have a form of survivor's guilt, if you will? I'm sure there's a better term for that. But the fact that you have been successful as you compare to others in your family and yes, of course, your parents.
I think, what a thoughtful and profound question. I mean, I probably should take that up in therapy. I probably do. I mean, I think the survivor's guilt on the one hand, having to do with, you know, just being able to cobble together a life and make a really good and productive and very satisfying go of it in my life. I'm very fortunate to have been able to do that as a writer. And I think also my cohorts, many of my fellow writers and artists and theater artists who, you know, we give up a lot in order to make lives in the arts in America. And a lot of the compensations, most of the compensations are not economic, and most of the sacrifices are, you know. And so I feel very fortunate and probably do have some survivor's guilt with respect to many of my colleagues who I've seen, many cases, much more talented than I am. Somehow I've eked through and they haven't. So, yeah, I suppose I am dealing with some survivor guilt, though. Again, as I said, I should probably take it up in therapy before I talk about it too much more. So.
You have talked about this in the writing of the book, and I found it fascinating. Obviously, it's not mentioned in the novel, and I wouldn't know about it unless it came out of an interview. But from the time the last part of the book is about your father and about a court case that he is going through, and then there is a coda. From the time mm-hmm. that the final chapter was written to the coda, your father, your real father, passes away.
Yeah.
That has to be devastating. I mean, obviously, the loss of a parent is devastating. But I'm curious, does it have an effect on what you had written prior?
Well, you know, it was so shocking, because actually that chapter you're talking about, the last section of the book, it's really a quarter of the book. It's really just a portrait of my dad, portrait of the state, and through the lens of this malpractice lawsuit that's largely inspired by a real malpractice lawsuit my dad dealt with toward the end of his career. And the day that I finished that chapter, literally the day that I finished that chapter, was the day that I got a call from my brother about an hour after closing my computer, saying that my dad had hit his head and he was headed to ICU, and where he would later die of a subdural hematoma. And yes, I hadn't written the coda yet. And I guess I wasn't exactly sure how his story would end. I knew his story would end in some sense, you know, one way or the other, but I didn't know it would end the way that it did. And he had been talking so much about going back home to Pakistan, even though he'd spent much of his American life sort of saying America was home and how much he hated Pakistan and never wanted to go back. But toward the end of his life, all he talked about was wanting to go back. And so, you know, in that coda, I'm able to, what I basically, I have him back home. I have him back on these mango groves that he, his family had inherited for many generations. And you know, he's there and happily ensconced in his mango groves. And we're connecting over Skype because I can't get a visa to go back to Pakistan. So, you know, it was a way to tell a deeper truth, or to complete a story that he was not able to complete in his own life. So maybe a tribute to him, if you will.
Does it have an effect, though, as you go back and through the rewriting and looking at the novel, before you submit it, does it have an impact on what you had written prior, given the intimacy that you write about and the relationship that the two of you had?
Yeah. No, it didn't. You know, when I set out to write this book, it was clear almost from the beginning that I was going to be writing in a way that was, as I said earlier, of course, fiction, but drawing so extensively from my own life that, and with such intimacy that I was going to hazard bringing profound disgrace on my family, as well as, and it also made it clear that I had to do that with myself, that I couldn't, you know, whatever compositing and whatever concoction I created, it couldn't be for my benefit. I would have to implicate myself as much as I implicated my family, as much as I was trying to implicate my fellow American citizens in the collapse that has become our politics. Because I think that we are ultimately all responsible. So in a sense, the book is really not an attempt to express anything personal. It was an attempt to use the personal material to express something much larger having to do with all of us. And in that respect, nothing really changed in my procedure, whether he was alive or dead. I did worry if he was alive, what he would make of it if he read it, but it did not inform how I approached writing it, because I knew that that was something that I was doing to myself as well.
In no way am I trying to play the part of a therapist that you mentioned earlier, but it seems there would be a point where what you're writing about all through the novel, but especially toward the end in that final chapter that you referenced, it's a very raw relationship and very fresh. And to write that even as it's going on, I mean, at one point in that chapter, your father in the book, in the novel, is responding to you writing down notes about him and knowing that you are taking notes about him and very concerned about how he will come out in this. And then while this is happening, your real father passes away. I mean, obviously that has to go through your mind of what he would make of that.
Well, again, as I said, you know, it was already in the book. You know, I would already written a section in which he's preoccupied by what I'm going to write about him. And I keep trying to manage his expectations and keep trying to tell him I won't write anything, you know, bad. I'll try to tell the truth, whatever that means, right? And you know, it's interesting that the notion of him finding the notebook, you know, it's that was, again, you know, for me, everything's about dramatic utility. So the fact that he could find that notebook and see the notes that the writer was taking, it becomes an opportunity for the conversation, the very conversation you're talking about, which then becomes an opportunity for the reader to be reflecting on this process of recording whatever it may be. And I think that at the end of the day, Joe, I think the thing that was surprising to me was the emotional heat inside me as I was writing this book. I mean, you know, one would imagine you'd need some time to work through some of this stuff, but in fact, you know, there was a mature emotional intensity to all of it that I couldn't account for. I don't know why it was all ready to be spoken the way that it was, but it came out of me largely it comes to you largely unchanged from how it came out of me. And sure, there was some revision, but not like usual. It wasn't a lot. And I can't really account for why that's the case.
You used the term breathless earlier of it coming out of you. And I thought that was interesting because, as I said, I read the novel and then I listened to you read it. You do the audiobook and you read it very quickly. And that isn't a criticism. It is an urgency that you have in your voice as you're telling the story, which I think makes it so vivid because there is that urgency that you feel, I assume, in the telling of the story. I mean, I don't know how much of that is just your cadence, but it seems.
Well, the cadence is, I'm trying to capture something that's on the page. It's something that was in me, you know?
Right.
That's,
So it seems to me that the same thing that I hear in your voice as you're urgently telling the story must have been how it felt as you were writing
it. Yes, that's exactly right. And I think, again, coming to the emotional circumstance of me having written, you know, coming to that writing moment with the decline of my parents, the passing of my mother, the evident collapse of our national politics, and the evident collapse of a kind of framework, an epistemological framework to know what's real anymore. And by that, I don't just mean fake news. Mm. I mean, I think that the, you know, I think I call it the toxic flotsam that is drifting through our consciousness on a daily basis because of the fragmented, atomized way that experience is conveyed to us by these devices is having a profoundly deleterious effect on our societies. And that's just a fact. That's just happening. Mm. And we're not really dealing with it because we can't, because we're caught in an economic cycle where companies of scale have so much power over our lives. And this is not a partisan issue. You know, the remarkable thing to me about the Republican sort of lack of an argument these days is that there is such a clear argument to be made for the Republican side siding with the working class against the corporate hegemony. There's such a clear case to be made for a conservative point of view that is not in the pocket of big, enormous companies of scale. There is this bubbling up of an anti-monopolist sentiment across the world. And it's not a partisan issue. This is just something that is not good for any of us. I mean, it's good for very few people, but for the rest of us, it isn't. But anyway, coming back to all of that, the urgency of our political and social moment married to the loss of my own parents and the passing of their American stories, if you will, and its sort of experience of being Muslim post 9/11 and dealing 19 years after 9/11, still dealing with the fact that Americans don't seem to understand the first thing about 9/11, about what it has meant to them, what the consequences of our inability to understand where it came from have resulted in, how the world order has really fallen apart in large part because we, out of vengeance and grief, destroyed that world order. And so dealing with all of that, all of it coming to a head for some reason in a moment of inspiration, grief, joy, rapturous, abandon to language, it just happened, and I can't really account for how or why.
As far as the political aspect of the book, I was fascinated because there's a character in the book who predicts that Donald Trump is going to win the election. The carbon dating of this phenomenon, if you will, which we now refer to as Trumpism, in the novel comes down to the single name Robert Bork.
I think, you know, I had a pretty profound realization maybe 3 or 4 years ago where, and I won't walk you through it, but it was one of those epiphanies, sort of, you know, life-changing epiphanies. I've had maybe 3 or 4 in my lifetime. And it had something to do with the social contract, the nature of the social contract that had changed. And that, you know, what we were expecting from our collective was something that was now being offered to us under the guise of the lowest price. That as long as we were given things at the lowest price, what was education, and of course it's not at the lowest price at all in that case, but that's the ideology, that the customer is first and foremost, and that anything is permissible as long as we extend to the customer the lowest price. And that somehow this had become the sort of central tenet, the bedrock tenet of a new social contract, which was enabling enormous changes to our national infrastructure, to our economic life, to our societies and our communities, to really the abandonment of the American heartland. And all of that was being justified by throwing up stores in the middle of nowhere that offered people the lowest price. And to me, this felt like a seismic revolution. And so I started to try to understand where this came from. And it took me a while to sort of settle on an object as clear and simple as Robert Bork, because I think there's a very good case to be made. Of course, Robert Bork didn't do it alone, but that Robert Bork really represents this shift of moving away from thinking about taking care of a larger ecosystem when it comes to commerce and focusing solely on the benefit to the consumer at any cost. And that this is the ideology that has enabled, for example, companies like Walmart to take over 50, 60% market share of groceries in certain markets. You know, in the late 60s, even an 8% market share, a merger between two grocery store chains that would have created an 8% market share was something judges didn't feel was justifiable because it was going to hurt workers and it was going to hurt business owners, even if it benefited consumers. So all the other stakeholders have disappeared. It's only the consumer. And that itself is a lie because ultimately the consumer is being lied to in order to benefit the shareholder, who is really the only stakeholder, which is another unfortunate development in our national economic life.
At the end of the novel, when you're talking about your father, you say, looking back, he said he realized he'd been playing a role so much of that time, a role he'd taken for real. Do you feel in some ways that you're playing a role as well?
That's a great question. I'm a man of the theater, Joe. So I'm probably comfortable with the metaphor of role playing, and I'm probably derived some inspiration from Shakespeare's articulation of it, that all the world's a stage, and we are merely players. I don't know, that's a facetious and somewhat facile and pretentious answer to your question, but there is some truth to it in the sense that I think that the dominant metaphor of the book is some performance, and there is a performance unfolding in so many different ways, performances. And I think that, the father's character at the end of the day does come to this recognition that he never really felt that he achieved the experience of being American. And I think it points to something about American identity, which at least in his case was not about nativism. It was about attainment to something, which is very different. It's a different experience of identity than knowing where you come from, that you come from a certain soil and that's where you're from and that's your home. Making your home somewhere else when your success in that land is what ultimately defines you, then there's a contingency to it that can feel, I think, like role play.
I long divorced myself from the process of trying to figure out truth versus fiction in the novel. Did your mother actually pretend to be one of David Letterman's doctors?
Oh my God.
And called the hospital at the time of his heart operation.
Yes, she did. Yes, she did.
Wow.
Yeah. She was so proud of it. She was so proud of it. And it was funny too, because she had actually initially told me not to tell my dad. She didn't want to tell my dad. So there's a bit of concoction around all the circumstances of how that emerges in the book and how that narrator relays that information and how it's related to him. All of that is that stuff. That's not real. But the actual story itself, she was such a huge fan of David Letterman and so disturbed by the fact that he had been, diagnosed with heart problems and that he had heart surgery and just wanted him to come back. Funny thing, I did the Stephen Colbert show early when he had just taken over. Stephen, I told Stephen the story about my mom being a huge Letterman fan, and I told this story in particular, and Stephen Colbert said, "Well, so what does she think about me? I mean, she's watching." He said, "I said, well, she's still on the fence about you. She's not convinced that you're stepped a leg up on David Letterman." So, yeah, no, she was a huge, huge Letterman fan.
Wouldn't be calling the hospital about his medical condition now.
Absolutely not. No, she wouldn't. She wouldn't care.
Well, the novel is just unputdownable, as Salman Rushdie says on the in his blurb, and that's absolutely true. It is a stunning piece of work. Homeland Elegies, a novel. It is published by Little Brown. Ayad Akhtar, I thank you so much for spending time with us. What a great honor and pleasure to speak to you.
Oh, the honor and pleasure was mine. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.